So welcome to Philosophy East. My name's Maitreya Bandhu. I live and work here at the London Buddhist Centre. And I've just been in conversation with Patrick Ophuls, who actually goes by the pen name William Ophuls. I've been reading his books. I first read Immoderate Greatness, Why Civilizations Fail. I've also then read The Tragedy of Industrial Civilization and Plato's Revenge. I mean, he's a remarkable writer who I'd really recommend you to read. The reason I wanted to do this conversation with him is really to get his work out there more. Nowadays, everyone says things as something is an important book. With Patrick Ophuls, his books really are important. They're saying really important things about our human situation, both at the macro level and the micro level, the personal psychological element of that, and what he calls the problematique, this interrelated network of what sometimes people call the meta-crisis, facing the modern life. His great genius, I said to him when I chatted to him, is concision. He sort of reads voraciously, obviously, and then incredibly concisely says, here's the things we need to think about. So, you know, Immoderate Greatness, that's only 90 pages long. You can read it in one sitting. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. It's the first of a whole series of conversations we're having here at Philosophy East, where we really want to talk to people about the state of the world and the state of consciousness. So Patrick Ophuls on Immoderate Greatness, Why Civilizations Fail. Really good to see you, Patrick. I've been very much looking forward to our conversation. I feel that we've got a lot in common and a lot to talk about. I mostly want to, in this conversation, talk about, in a way, your whole thesis about the human, what we are, and also how what we are affects our world. But I want to say a little bit first, because basically what I was very struck reading this book, Immoderate Greatness, which is an extended essay, and as I was just saying to you, it's a really striking example of concision. You know, you've read incredibly widely and told us what we need to know. But you're basically saying in that book that civilization is hardwired for self-destruction. And that by the time we realize that, it's already too late. It's very, very sobering to read. But perhaps let's start by saying, if you can, something about how come our civilization is hardwired for self-destruction. And is it too late?
Well, I'll go all the way back in history when, as long as human beings lived in Africa, they seemed to live in quite an ecological way. They were an apex predator, but they didn't fundamentally destroy or disturb ecosystems. But when they left Africa, they arrived in places with populations of megafauna who'd never seen human beings before. They were used to wolves and cave lions and so on. Well, the human beings fell on these fauna in Australia and Asia, in North America and other places, and basically wiped them out. That was your indication of what human beings are capable of when they come on a climax ecosystem. Mm. Second time they did that was when they began agriculture. Soil is another climax ecosystem. Mm. And instead of conserving it, they consumed it. Mm. And the quote I have in the book from the French writer Chateaubriand, before civilization, forests; after civilization, deserts. Mm. That seems to be the repeated pattern of civilization. Mm. Then we came to what historians call, in a terrible misnomer, the Columbian Exchange, when the Europeans discovered the New World and basically raped it. Mm. It was another kind of climax ecosystem, this time a cultural, political one, that, again, they just simply expropriated and exterminated. Mm-hmm. That has set the pattern for all of human history. That's who we are. Yeah. I'm sorry to say.
Yes, indeed.
And as a result of this so-called exchange, Europe gained the wealth and the and an intellectual infusion, which led to the whole modern world and to us discovering the tools with which to now to break into the ultimate climax, which is the world, the whole world. And what we're doing is we're doing exactly what we did to the woolly mammoth,
right,
or
yeah.
to the poor inhabitants of Peru when Pizarro arrived. We're raping and pillaging, and there's no other way to describe it. You can sugarcoat it, but that's what it is.
And you, what's striking again? There were so many things that are striking, but you sort of date the industrial technological civilization, starting with James Watt's steam engine, I think in 1763 or something like that. That civilization, most civilizations only exist for 250, 300 years before they self-destruct, which puts us quite late in that trajectory.
Yeah, of course, that's a rough estimate that I got from Sir John Glubb. And it's not an absolute rule. For example, the Byzantine civilization survived for much longer, and so on.
Right, yeah.
But nevertheless, that seems to be the pattern, that the civilization arises. Sooner or later, it burns through all its resources and comes to an end. The end comes in many forms, just a collapse or a conquest or whatever it is. There are all these... let's say random historical factors that affect the outcome of the story, but the essence of the story remains the same.
Yes.
It rises, it peaks, it falls.
Yes, that's right. And that, as I say, places us near, very near the end, possibly very near the end of a civilization.
What really concerns me now, excuse me, I have a throat issue due to allergies. What really concerns me now is that we see an acceleration, and a lot of scientists are quite concerned about that. We see an acceleration toward the tipping points. And once those tipping points get transgressed, there may be no way back. And you will have an acceleration toward some kind of collapse. How that collapse occurs, no, that depends on so many historical variables. When the critical threshold is crossed, again, don't know. But if you look at, for example, one of the key tipping points, which is an open ocean in the Arctic during the summer, originally predicted for the 50s, looks now might be in the 30s.
Right,
okay. So we may be a decade away from this critical tipping point. And the reason it's so important is it affects four other tipping points: the thawing of the permafrost, the possible release of frozen methane on the seabed, the Greenland glaciers, and the AMOC, Atlantic meridional overturning current that controls the weather in the northern hemisphere.
So what I wanted to go carry on, yeah.
So I am not encouraged about the life of my grandchildren. I think they're going to face incredible difficulties.
And we do even seem to see, I mean, possibly everybody always thinks this at any time, but we do seem to see a cascading political nightmare as well all around us.
Exactly, and I think the two in some way go together. And as you know, the fifth chapter of my book is about moral entropy.
Yes, that's right.
It's like the physical world running down, the morals and mores can run down. I'm now 90 years old, so I've seen a certain measure of history. And the contrast between when I grew up in the 30s and now, it's like night and day.
Yes, I bet.
And there's so many symbols of that. My granddaughters dress in a way which would have gotten them thrown into jail in the 1930s.
imagine.
You were not allowed to bear that much skin unless you were in a swimming pool.
Indeed. So listen, I want to make sure we get to human moral entropy particularly, because I want to focus our conversation as much as we can around us as human beings, especially our hubris that you write about a lot. But I think it'd be good to talk about the problematique first, because when I've been talking to friends about your work, I've been wanting to emphasize your concept of a problematique. It seems to me a very important one, and it helps us not just try to think of things in separate little encampments and make minor adjustments.
Yeah, that is indeed the core of the problem we face in a practical sense, and that there are so many things going wrong at the same time and requiring so many solutions, and these solutions get in the way of each other. And a perfect example of how you can get trapped in the problematique, to my mind, is the selling of electric cars as the solution to our problems. All that's doing is piling more entropy on the entropy that we already have. The existing cars don't go away, but the new cars come, and those new cars require resources from all over the world. Those new cars are heavier, so they cause more and worse accidents. The rubber beats down the streets and dissolves into particles that get into our lungs. It's just you start chasing your own tail, and you start running into conflicts everywhere you turn. If I make this better, I'm going to make this worse or complicate this other solution. That's where we are. That's the problematique. And other people call it the polycrisis.
Yes, I've heard
It's
that term, or a
essentially the same
metacrisis.
idea. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the same idea. Let's talk a bit more about cars. I thought the example of cars was particularly striking to me reading the books. That well, one of the things that you say, I think it's one of the interviews I've listened to where you said, "Look, no one's going to give up their car. It'll be like Charlton Heston saying, 'Out of my dead hand,' it's an unimaginable society without cars, and yet that does seem to be exactly what needs to happen."
It's a bit like the Asian monkey trap. The monkey sticks its fist in to get the food and then can't release its grip and is trapped. That's us as a civilization. We're trapped by our modern conveniences, which we don't want to give up and can't possibly give up. I mean, we'd all starve to death,
Yes, that's
basically, if fossil fuel came to an end today.
it's very striking, the example of cars, because, and this connects to another thing I want to touch on a bit, is your whole thesis on technology. But one of the things that people say is that, cities were about to go under sort of a mass of horse manure. That it was just getting to that moment where horse manure was going to drown us. And then guess what? We invented the car. And that's created this sort of assumption that technology will, at the moment of crisis, sort everything out, get rid of all the horse poo,
Sure, yeah. And there are people, for example, who put their hopes in we can go all electric. We can get rid. Well, that leaves out agriculture. I mean, you're not going to electrify your wheat. You may electrify the tractor, but all the other inputs that go into modern agriculture depend on fossil fuel. So the idea you could electrify everything is already a pipe dream. But even if you go to the max, it takes energy and materials to build all those solar arrays and all the other gizmos that you're relying on to make electricity. And they only last for so long. What do you do 30 years, 35 years later? They all have to be replaced. All that crap has to go somewhere. And you have to completely rejigger your electrical grid, which again, costs money, resources, energy. And I think I used the example somewhere in my book, like you're trying to rebuild a ship while you're sailing in the ocean.
Right, yeah.
You can't take civilization off, put it in a dockyard and fix it, and wait, you know, a year and get back in the ocean. It doesn't work that way.
Of course.
That you're really stuck that way.
I mean, the other thing, you also talk about the problem of creating electricity, how much waste there is. So it's easy to forget that. I can't remember the sum now, but it's an incredible amount of wastage to turn fossil fuel into electricity.
Yeah, a tremendous amount of waste. And then people put their hopes in something like fusion. I think fusion is possible in the laboratory because they've already demonstrated that for a nanosecond, you can actually have fusion. But if you look at the inputs that are needed to make that happen, it's hard for me to believe that you could have a power plant. It would either cost the earth or be so big that it would be impossible. So there's no infinite source of energy. Again, everywhere you're running into the second law of thermodynamics, that energy runs downhill. You either pay the price now or you pay the price later.
Yes, indeed.
There's no way around it. I don't, you probably remember the book by C.P. Snow, The Two Cultures.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, where he was also a published author and literary critic and so on, as well as being a physicist. And he got tired of people criticizing scientists for being so ignorant about culture. And then he asked, well, do you know the second law of thermodynamics? And they all went, no, I don't. I don't need to.
Yeah.
So that's comparable to not knowing who Shakespeare was.
Right. Yeah, yes, that's right.
That's the level of ignorance in the society as a whole.
Yeah.
People simply don't understand some of these basic physical laws or laws of ecology.
Yeah. I mean, that is something, I'm really struck in reading your work, Patrick, is how widely you range. It's very difficult to describe what kind of writer you are, because you know, we go to Jung, and we'll talk more about Jung and spirituality at one end, but you also go to fusion and politics and at the other. I mean, in a way, I think that's exactly what we need. We need a joined-up way that includes our human consciousness as part of the issue.
And you're absolutely right. And the fundamental problem with our intellectual life in general, and academic life in particular, is that it's in silos. There are very few people who are what I call specialists in the general who are able to relate physics to psychology, to ecology, to whatever. And that's, to my mind, what is absolutely essential at this point. Because if you're dealing with a problematique, you can't have a one-track mind. You can't have a tunnel mind. You have to be able to accommodate all the elements of the problem, whether it's mental or physical or economic or ecological.
I mean,
it's part of a whole puzzle. You have to fit it together.
I mean, you're a model of that. Let's just make sure that people are clear what the problematique is, because we might not have quite clarified that. So I understand it as being a sort of mesh of problems, which to solve one problem actually worsens another, like your example of electric cars and the weight of the electric car and so on. And I do think that's a very important thought you've got there. I wonder whether you might just say a bit more about what precisely a problematique is, because probably a term that people haven't come upon. And people do still think of discrete problems, including things like mental health at one end and technology at another, you know.
Sure. I don't know that I can say too much more than I already have, except that you get a nexus of problems with solutions that compete with each other. Or a solution that takes resources away from one sector for itself and therefore deprives the other sector of the resources it needs to solve the problem.
Right, yeah.
And it's partly just economics, it's partly physics, but it's also mental.
Yeah.
That people find it very hard to put their mind around the total problem and see how it all relates. And it's for all that I've done to study it, I don't pretend to understand the whole problem.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And that's part of the problem, is that it's ungraspable and therefore beyond any kind of rational solution.
Yes, indeed.
And,
so before
and,
we
and the
before
difficulty
we talk,
is
go
the difficulty is for us is that inevitably, as we try and solve this problem and that problem, we're just making more problems for ourselves at this point in our civilizational existence. If we had, when the limits to growth study, the computer study that really, if we at that time had started to take appropriate measures, it would be possible that we could get a grasp on the problem. But having let it grow so big and so overwhelming, and to be in such a degree of overshoot, that's where the difficulty lies.
Mm-hmm.
We're no longer faced with a collection of reasonable problems. We're faced with this polycrisis of problems that all look like they're insoluble on their own terms, much less as a collectivity.
Yeah, I think that's so
clarified.
Important. Yeah, that clarifies it very, very much. Like if you go back to cars, you know, you could imagine in a sort of dream world that at some point we decided not to go down that way and spent all that money on really good public services.
Exactly.
Which,
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if we had acted, say, in 1972, when the Limits to Growth study came out, it might have been possible.
Mm.
I doubt it. Just my faith in human nature is pretty low at this point.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
I think the Charlton Heston response would have dominated you.
Yeah.
You're not going to take my car away from me.
Yeah, that's right. I'm afraid I can't see any other way of understanding that. You know, it would be naive to. I mean, the other thing, just before we keep mooring about the person side of this, the other thing that really struck me reading the book, your books, was something I hadn't realized that I believed, which I somehow had come to think that technology creates energy rather than uses it. Somehow I've got technology mixed up with the creation of energy. I thought it was like sort of something, the veils falling from behind. I don't even know where I got that idea. You know, I just weirdly picked it up.
You got that idea from the culture, the way everybody gets their ideas. You know, that has been somehow the hidden assumption that nobody bothered to examine.
Yes, that's right.
But it's very, very clear to anybody with a physics background that's true, and that's the limitation on what we can do. Technology is wonderful, but what are you going to use it for?
Yeah.
To aggrandize yourself, to create a more luxurious life? What's the end?
Yeah. Like you use the example, I couldn't find out where I'd found it, about dams in the US. You know, and how they were built. I don't know when they were built, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, and that, you know, they're massively needing repair. And if we keep on, the civilization keeps on exponentially growing, as you talk about, we'll end up, we need another however many, which is just becomes an impossible feat.
Yeah, that's the factor of exponential growth, is that it sneaks up on you. And then all of a sudden it becomes overwhelming. You know, you have to completely rebuild your infrastructure. And you don't have the money and the time to do it.
Mm-hmm. So let's move more now, because I'm particularly wanting to focus on our part, our human part. I mean, you talk about the four biophysical limits: ecological exhaustion, exponential growth that we've just touched on, expedited entropy, excessive complexity. Then we've got these two human factors, which are human error and moral failure, basically. So I was so struck by you saying, I think in the preface of Immoderate Greatness, a genuine cure would require a revolution in human thought greater than the one that created the modern world. Yeah. I was very struck by that. And by other comments you've made like that, that the real issue is a revolution of consciousness. In Plato's Revenge, you say, we are not yet ready to admit that the destruction of nature is the consequence not of policy errors that can be remedied by smarter management, better technology, and stricter regulation, but rather of a catastrophic moral failure that demands a radical shift in consciousness.
Yeah. Well, I go back to what I said earlier, that human nature has certain flaws.
Right, yeah. Let's go into those flaws a bit, I think.
Yeah, and if this band of hunter-gatherers departs from Africa and suddenly runs into a troop of woolly mammoths, well, that's lunch for some time, and they're going to just chew right through it until there are no more woolly mammoths.
Yeah.
And then slowly they will accommodate themselves to the new situation. But I'm afraid that's just built into our genes.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about, you quote Jung's 2-million-year-old man and talk about, say something about our Paleolithic mindset, because I think I do want people to get more realistic about that Paleolithic mindset, because sometimes we act as if we're terribly urban sophisticates, which perhaps we are on the top, but it's a very thin top.
It's a very thin top. I agree with you. Civilization is a veneer.
Right. Yeah.
We're not that far removed from chimpanzees.
Mm-hmm.
We need to recognize that. If we don't understand the human propensity for evil, then I think we're in big trouble. And that's where the great religions of the world come in for all their problems and faults, is that there is this recognition that there needs to be some higher value in the world which provides a check on human will and appetite, because without that, it can run wild and be destructive and self-destructive.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the themes in your book, that we need this higher check on human will and appetite. What we seem to be doing is having a world in which appetite has become more, even in my time, I'm in my 60s now, I can see appetite, even in my time, becoming more and more the dominant factor.
More and more voracious.
Yeah, more and more voracious. More and more, if I want it, I can have it. Who's to say not, you know?
And I'm as guilty as anyone, you know. I discover, I need something. Well, Amazon's right there to send it to my doorstep.
Yes, that's right. Same here.
Yeah, we're all implicated, you know, right up to here.
Yes, indeed. Well, you know, I'm here at the London Buddhist Centre, and you wouldn't believe how many Amazon packages we get. I can tell you, it's an embarrassment.
No, and yet, there's really no way out of it. I live with my family and they want to live an ordinary life. I live in Los Angeles. Without a car, you're nobody. You can get nowhere.
Yeah,
you know. So, yeah, it's not that you're guilty and I'm not. We're all in this together.
Yeah.
There's something about your thesis of the human that's also trying to say, look, it's not our fault. It's just that we are Paleolithic man, as it were. You know, we need to sort of get a sort of grip with that. Like, I was very struck, for instance, how you say, look, basically we're very alert to the present and the dramatic. We're very good at we tend to think in short term ways, don't we? I think it'd be good to just say more a little bit about that, because I think that's a very important sort of starting point, that we're short term creatures. Things show up to us in a very particular kind of way that is to do with our ancient structure, not to do with necessarily what we think is best.
You've essentially provided the kernel of that idea that we grew up as hunters and gatherers on the African savanna, and we didn't need to think about a year from now. Our problem was to find lunch today, or to ward off the predators today, or to have a song and dance festival today. There was just no concern for the long-term future. People did have children, obviously. They wanted them to grow up and thrive and all that. But it wasn't an intellectual matter. Mm. Now we're faced with a situation where we have to accommodate intellectually these incredible number of variables, yeah, and over a whole course of time. And our mind just isn't capable of doing it. Mm. And much worse, and here we come to Ian McGilchrist's thesis, which I think is absolutely correct, is that the left brain has run away with us. Instrumental rationality dominates the world, has created this world. And we're trying to solve the problem created by that with more instrumental rationality. And it doesn't work because we've become disconnected in a way from that 12 million year old man who had a kind of wisdom about how to live in an environment that we've completely lost.
Indeed. Yeah, indeed. Another thing that you talk about, staying with this, the Paleolithic man for a moment, is, you know, as you say, we're not good at complexity, and here we are in a unbelievably complex world that is now too complex for the human brain to manage. Then you were saying we're very dualistic in our thinking. I'm struck by that, seeing my daughters being educated, how dualistic everything is. Good and bad, right and wrong.
Yeah. Dualistic and reductionistic. Mm. Yeah. People are not given the whole picture. Academic life, everybody in their little silo, rarely, although it's beginning to change. I see some more examples of people willing and able to cooperate across disciplinary lines. Mm. I think ecology has had a positive effect on the whole of academic life from that point of view, but still not enough. And the economics profession in particular, just lives in its own little silo, and they play mathematical ping pong with each other, and it has no relationship to the real world.
Yeah, I can imagine. So we're moving towards not a solution, but one of the things you talk about, the striking thing again in reading you is that we can be talking about one side of the world almost, and then right back into another. So you then start to talk about the vital role of mores, which I was very struck by, and this whole question of layered democracy. But I was very struck by your discussion of the vital role in human life of mores, of being governed from within.
Exactly, because I quote Rousseau, mores are the keystone of our collective life. And without them, if everybody just went around breaking laws willy-nilly, there's no amount of police that could keep society together. Mm. Without that kind of internal, I won't say policeman, but judge maybe, to channel and control human will and appetite, then people start to do really outrageous things. Here in Los Angeles, people routinely run red lights. It's like it doesn't mean anything anymore that the light turns red. If I can somehow make it across the intersection without smashing into somebody, I'm going to do it. Or another example, just this morning on the walk, there's a sign on a fence, post no signs. Somebody came along with a blackout and changed it to post signs.
Oh, really?
Like that. That kind of egoistical attitude and behavior has just become more common.
Yes, yeah.
If I can get away with it, I'm going to do it.
Yes.
But once the mores disappear, the moral fabric is broken, then society is beginning to run down. That's moral entropy or social entropy as well.
And you talk about the our moral, and I was, again, struck by this, it's very much things follows my own thinking and my own teacher's thinking, is that we've been living on the fossil fuel of the Christian world.
Exactly.
I mean, Nietzsche was the first person to say that, wasn't he? To say, look, we don't believe in the basis of our morality anymore, and that's not going to work. His predictions have come horribly true, haven't they? You know, that we've been living off this fossil, I loved how you called it fossil fuel.
Fossil virtue, I call it.
Fossil virtue, that's right, that's better. You know, that is breaking down more and more, isn't it, that fossil virtue from the Judeo-Christian tradition.
Yeah, that both on the sort of the moral side of human behavior, but also on the political side. Right. And that's really a disaster because our modern political system are basically along Lockean lines. And the key in Locke is the civil society. If you don't have a strong civil society, you can't have representative democracy. It just doesn't work. And you're seeing that play out in the United States in so many ways that without that as a basis, democracy is meaningless. It just doesn't work. Mass democracy in general doesn't work, in my opinion, but it used to work somewhat, let's put it that way.
Well, again, you quote, I think it's Aristotle saying that democracy only works if you know everyone.
Yeah,
I thought it was a brilliant
insight.
You
have to be a judge of their character, and now what we get is a flim-flam show of people buying it's just outright lies that appear on television and all this political campaigning.
Well, it's striking that, you know, Aristotle's idea of, you know, knowing everyone and therefore being able to judge their character, whether they would therefore be a good leader and honest and truthful and all that sort of thing, I think that's been replaced by self-marketing largely, or by the marketing industry.
The solution, somewhat utopian solution that I put forward in The Tragedy of Industrial Civilization is indirect democracy. That you have a small group, all of people know each other, and they know, well, Joe would be the right guy to be our leader, or Mary, whoever it is, and we elect them. Then all the Joes and Marys get together and pick the best of them. Like all human systems, it will certainly not work perfectly. But I think that's a way to retain some semblance of democracy when you get to larger populations where nobody knows anything and where the reason to vote for somebody is because you saw some ad on the TV which told you the other guy was a monster.
Yes, that's right. But you can, as we start to explore things like this, you can really see that an incredible revolution in the human psyche, in human consciousness. Because all of that presupposes that, doesn't it? Like, we need to find a basis for mores now. You know, you were saying in the book that, you know, you simply can't replace them with more and more laws. Here in London, you know, you have a go on the tube and it says, be kind, you know, don't stare at people. More and more things are trying to be made explicit, you know, be kind, be generous, it's good for your health to be generous and so on. As mores start to break down, as that fossil virtue that you write about breaks down.
And in New York, people jump over the fair styles, routine, that kind of behavior. It's like, I don't care what the law is. I don't care what it is. I'm just going to do what I want to do.
And for that to be different, there needs to be something, there needs to be a kind of, for want of a better word, a spiritual underpinning, a religious underpinning, some kind of. I was very struck by you saying, I think you quote Jung saying, the decisive question for man is he related to something infinite or not? You know, as so often Jung hits the nail on the head, doesn't he?
Absolutely.
You know, are we related to something infinite or not? If the answer is not, all we can do is create more and more literal rules, which people then get around, as you say, you know.
I think he really hits the nail on the head. If we don't, we're not related somehow to something higher, something sacred, then we're really lost sheep.
And you know, one of the things that we've got in common is both of us have turned to Buddhism. You can see here I am at the London Buddhist Centre. You know, I hardly need to point that out. We both turned to Buddhism as a response to that. I'm interested why you didn't, for in your own, you turned to Buddhism as well, Patrick. You've been practicing Buddhism for 50 years. Why didn't you turn to God? Because what I'm seeing a lot is also a sort of rise of a new interest in a very subtle and often beautifully argued theism, or at least a sort of metaphorical theism. Why didn't you turn to that, do you think?
Well, that could be a long story, but the essence was my family was not religious, so I wasn't brought up. I went to a series of schools, some of which tried to beat Christianity into me, and that didn't work. And then when I was an undergraduate at Princeton University, I took a course in Chinese landscape painting. As in what we call an elective, you know, off your major track, but acquire some culture.
Indeed.
And the teacher strolled in, and he was an older man with a long mane of white hair. And men didn't have manes of white hair in those days. So he had this sage-like aspect. And the first thing he said was, "We're not going to look at a scroll until you guys understand Taoism." So we spent the first 3 weeks studying Taoism. Now, studying Taoism is, of course, a contradiction in terms, but something happened on that third week, and I kind of got a Taoist worldview, a little taste of it. And then he began showing the scrolls and so on. Well, that stayed with me, and then I won't recount all the other experiences, but being in Japan for 4 years was definitely part of it, even though I didn't go to explicitly to Buddhist practice, and then I came back to graduate school, and I saw a movie with hippies doing Tai Chi, and something inside me said, "You got to do that," and so I began the study of Tai Chi. And at a certain point, I turned to the teacher and I said, "You know, this is really about the mind, isn't it?" He said, "You're a smart boy." So I said, "Well, then maybe I've got to do meditation." And the only game in town was what was it, Maharishi.
Oh, worried. Wow, crikey.
So holding my nose, I went to get initiated and began that. It didn't take. But I'd already sort of begun. I met somebody, and through her, I met a teacher of Buddhism, a fellow named Dhiravamsa, who used to teach in London, by the way, many years ago. That was the beginning of my long Buddhist career. Many hours spent on a cushion.
Yes, indeed, yeah. And has how in the books you don't write about it very much. You've written your own book on meditation, which is rather good, and which I've got upstairs. You don't write about it very much. How much has it influenced your thought, do you think?
Well, Wow, I could answer that in a number of ways. I think if you practice meditation long enough, it opens your mind in so many dimensions that it just seems natural to connect all the dots from all those different directions, not to have a one-track mind.
Yes, that's right.
I really think that's true, so that meditation is not just a moral foundation. I think it's also an intellectual one.
Yes, that's right. I wish more people realize that, because sometimes people think that Buddhism is just about being in some sort of soft way, about being in the moment. I don't know what that, there's, you won't find that in Buddhism anywhere, as if it doesn't think anything,
Yeah. So, yeah, I think it has inevitably shaped my thought, but not in any particular explicit way. And as you know, I draw very heavily on the Western tradition of political philosophy. So that's been the intellectual foundation of my writing career.
Yes, that's right. And yet I find when reading you how much I feel a very similar, you talk about the need for simplicity, frugality, and fraternity, for instance, which is my understanding of the Buddhist conception of a new world, a new society.
Exactly. Yes.
That's what a Buddhist, Buddhism, people easily think that Buddhism is something you do on your own with your eyes closed, don't they? But it's as much about us, it's as much about community and friendship and a new society, a new context, as it is about myself,
Yeah, absolutely. I agree 100% that it changes everything in your life if you practice Buddhism seriously and have good teachers and all that sort of thing.
In the book as well, you talk about, the basically the need to be wise. I've come to think that that is the great matter facing us. Human beings aren't naturally wise. As you say, civilization is thin. It might be, I wonder whether it might be worth saying why it's thin, because I think a lot of people don't think it's thin and might think, oh no, we've moved on from Paleolithic man. That's too pessimistic a judgment. I've had friends tell me, oh, but Maitreya Bhandu, people have been talking about the end of civilization since, since the Hebrews, so it's just another thing, that one can easily get dismissed as being pessimistic.
Well, I guess nobody's heard of World War II and how destructive and violent and terrible that was. I guess nobody's reading the newspapers to see what's happening in Gaza at this moment. And if nobody reads history generally, and if history were told more honestly, I think. You know, historians calling what happened between Europe and the Americas an exchange, I mean, that is just a travesty. It was not an exchange. It was completely a one-way transaction. It's a violation or a rape. If people only, paid attention to our history, they would understand how thin the veneer is. And in books that tried to sum up human history, you come upon that concept over and over. Current civilization, it doesn't take much. It takes years, eons to build up a civilization. It can disappear in a day. Again, people, this is going to sound terribly judgmental, but people are fundamentally ignorant. In the Buddhist sense, and in the more practical sense of lacking a deep understanding of human nature, human history, human society. I don't really know who we are as a species or who we are as persons, and that gets them into just all kinds of trouble.
Yeah, it just makes us sort of terribly naive so often. you know, foolishly naive. I mean, one of the things, again, in Plato's Revenge, you sort of explore a whole possibility of education. We need a fundamentally different kind of education that's about making us more like the Greeks, you know, making us wise and healthy and emotionally positive, not just sort of weirdly clever in a very sort of broken off way, you know.
Right. Again, back to Ian's work that we have become so focused on that instrumental rationality side of the human mind that the rest, which is the core of our really deep humanity, that's gotten lost.
Yeah. And again, in Plato's Revenge, you talk a lot about the importance of metaphor and myth as the only language that really will address the deeper mind, you know.
Exactly, because that comes from that right brain.
Yeah.
And if you don't speak to that, all you get is something superficial.
Mm.
You get a technological solution that doesn't really solve the problem.
Mm. Yeah. So you've got this sort of strong sort of argument for story, really, and for, you know, and how human beings learn by metaphor. People easily think that metaphor is just like a sort of fanciful way of putting things that you could put much better, you know, in prose, as it were, you know.
Yeah. But that's actually the better way to put it, because that grabs hold of your psyche in a way.
Yeah.
That merely technical explanation. And you can see people's fascination with story by the grip that television has on people's minds these days. People are hungry for stories, but they're getting fed crap.
Yeah.
instead of something educational and uplifting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's amazing what great story can do, isn't it? You know, it can... You know, you come out of seeing King Lear or something and you feel like you understand reality more, but you can't say in what way. You can't say, oh, I know that people can go mad or, you know, daughters can become nasty. It's not that. It's some way you can't express.
Yeah. And so Shakespeare and Tolstoy and all of them are an essential part of making us more civilized.
Yeah,
more able to act wisely, but that's not the direction of the modern world, unfortunately.
No, indeed, and you sort of wonder how will we move towards simplicity, frugality, and fraternity. I mean, I think that's a very good way of, as I said, I think that's the Buddhist vision of a new society, and even in my work here, and even in my own practice, you know, I can see how I fall short of those things, very, very much so. I'm not too bad on fraternity, but simplicity and frugality, I'm, you know, I wouldn't want to boast about, you know. How do we become wise seems to be the great question that lies almost underneath the books, because it's our lack of wisdom that, you know, our natural lack of wisdom, in a certain sense, even though we're ignorant, it's not our fault that we're ignorant. You know,
that's true, yeah.
You know, we didn't decide to be, we didn't wake up in the morning and think, I tell you what, I'll just be ignorant. You know, we sort of, it's just our nature, and how do we turn our ignorance into wisdom? And as I said, both of us have turned to Buddhism as a path of that.
Right. You know, I don't have the answer to that, except that... in human history, again and again, prophets have arisen.
Mm.
Prophets have arisen, and they've had a mixed impact, but they have led people toward a better way of life.
Mm.
And I have kind of a feeling that in the chaos that I think is coming inevitably, that in that chaos, one might hope that a prophet or more than one prophet arise to lead people to a better way of life.
Mm.
A much reduced population, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think you talked about to be sustainable, we need there needs to be like 2 billion rather than 8 billion or whatever the current estimation is.
Yeah, we need to be closer to 2 billion. And by the way, that's an estimate that's found widely among people who do the back of the envelope calculation, because that's really all you can do. 1 to 2 billion, maybe 3 billion maximum, depending on your assumptions.
And that in Plato's Revenge, particularly, you're creating a morals that is based in ecology. You know, you're arguing for, you know, it's a bit like almost a Nietzschean argument to try and find an underpinning to our morality that Nietzsche thought was so needed after the so-called death of God. That somehow we need to find a reason to act morally, to a reason to, as it were, monitor ourselves rather than have lots of posters telling us to be kind and not stare at people.
Sure. The problem, of course, is that my book is quite utopian and that it assumes that somehow people will intellectually come to that understanding, again, as opposed to having the great prophet arise and through charisma inspire people. The Arab historian Ibn Khaldun said, without a prophet, no civilization. I think that's probably widely true.
Let's just finish a bit from another book, The Tragedy of Industrial Civilization. You end up with these scenarios at the end. It's a frightening place to end, but I was very struck by them. Again, you know, in your sort of genius for concision, you could say, well, here's a bait. I wonder whether we might go through those scenarios, you know. That you finish the book with. Again, you know, The Tragedy of Industrial Civilization. It's not a long book, you know, anyone can read this. It's not, you know, you're not asking masses and masses of time from us. You're willing to help us by sort of thinking in a very concise way. So you start with utopia there, you know.
I try to write for the reasonably educated person, but not for PhD students.
Yes, that's right, yeah. Well, you seem to be trying to write outside of that, really. Didn't you say that you couldn't write the books you wanted to within academia?
Well, of course, my first book was the a recasting of my PhD thesis, so it's pretty heavy.
Right.
And my second book, too, and from the experience of writing the second book, I realized, no, I have to do it a different way. This is beating the reader over the head.
Right, yeah, of course. So you end up with five scenarios. So the first one is utopia, in which you say the probability is zero.
I think the probability of utopia has always been zero, again, because of our fundamental human nature.
Yes, that's right.
And again, because of entropy. It's like Plato says in the Republic, if we build the perfect city, it'll start to decay tomorrow. So utopia, take that off the table right away. Think about it.
We just can't do it, can we, really?
Can't do it.
We're not those kind of creatures, basically. and then you talk about, you know, rather frighteningly, of extinction. Can you say something about that?
If we were to get a real pulse of methane, say, we could get runaway heating that would take us to hothouse Earth that I don't think humanity could survive. Much of the animal life that even now exists could survive. The Earth would survive. Life would survive. Earth will take anything that anybody wants to throw at it, and we'll find a way to make the life process go. But whether human beings are part of that picture is another story.
And what is what do you? I can't remember what you say the probability is there. I think you were saying it could happen soon.
It definitely could happen. I mean, there's there's unfortunately a pathway to hot outside. If we carry on the way that we have and as I say, the methane starts to be released in very high quantities. It would be game over, essentially.
But then you talk about Armageddon, and interestingly, you think that that is unlikely, or at least less likely, in the idea of nuclear war and so on.
Well, you can throw all kinds of things in there: nuclear war, again, Armageddon. Possibly extinguish higher life. You know, it depends on too many different factors.
And people, you were saying in the book that even the most despotic leader knows that it's sort of suicide.
But you see leaders today willing to play on the edge.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
When you do that, sometimes you slip off the edge.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And then the thing that really struck me was you were saying the most likely one is business as usual until we're overtaken by this problematique that you've been drawing our attention to. I mean, it's very, very hard to argue with that, I found, that that's what we'll try and do. We're just sort of built like that, aren't we? Are we, like you say, we're like that monkey in the trap. You know, we've already put our hand in, you know, so we can't, anyway, perhaps say something about that. But I was very struck by, we just want business as usual. We don't mind a few tweaks, you know. And
Yeah. But we're trapped by our way of life, by our intellectual framework, and by our all too human nature. And we're like the mind, we can't let go. So that's the most likely future. That's the one that's playing out for sure.
Yeah, that's the one that's playing out. And then finally, you talk about civilization survives, because it's not the world that will be destroyed. It's civilization will have to change drastically,
radically. Yeah, a total moral revolution that accompanies a physical revolution. Whether it's too late for that, without an intervening interlude of basically barbarian kingdoms and so on, and civilization reforming on other grounds, a new prophet arises, and we're learning from our mistakes finally, and we'll do it this way.
I mean, perhaps we should try and finish with something, because, you know, from a Buddhist point of view, you know, from my own point of view, the fact that civilizations come and go is part of its assumptions, that all things are like that, that all things are impermanent is absolutely the central Buddhist doctrine, and that we need to learn about that and live in accordance with that and gain insight into that.
And be at peace with that.
Yes.
May not be a delightful prospect, but you can be at peace with that.
Yeah. Perhaps, can you say a bit about how, perhaps to finish, how is your own Buddhist practice, has it helped you with that? I mean, I didn't know you were a Buddhist, Patrick, until listening to, you know, I do my exercises after my meditation in the morning to try and stave off, you know, old age, as long as I can. And I was very struck, they were discussing immoderate greatness, and right at the end you say, well, this isn't the time to preach Buddhism. They say, look, everyone ends up with saying, look, what are we going to do here? You know, and you were saying, look, this isn't the time to preach Buddhism, but that's what I've done. I wonder whether you might find a way of saying more about how that helps you be at peace with all the things you write about. I had a dream after reading one of your books just the other day. Again, in fact, I read Immoderate Greatness twice, which is unheard of for me. I was reading it like a kind of sutra to disabuse me of the future, if you see what I mean. Because you can so easily think, well, we'll do the future, rather than let's be kind and wise now. You know, I found it sort of a helpful way of kind of shaking me off the future. But I had this dream, you know, just the other day, looking at it again, where I was in a meeting, a Buddhist meeting, and there was this huge tsunami, this huge wave coming towards us. And we were in this office block, and I was saying, you know, look at that wave. And someone was saying, oh, no, it's all right, we're just by the sea. That's all, you know. And I was saying, no, no, it's not just we're by the sea. Something quite catastrophic is on its way. My friends have been telling me to stop reading you.
That's your mental health.
Yes, indeed. I mean, what I find is I think you write with great honesty and vigour, and you won't patronise people, which I think is essential if we're going to grow at all. We've got to know who we are if we're going to grow at all. We can't grow based on some sort of fantastical idea about how lovely we are. You know, that will just break down again and again, personally and more broader. So how has your own Buddhist practice helped you had a sort of peace with the things that you can see? Because you can see much more about the world than I am. I live it in a much more of a bubble. I'm a sort of arts type. You know, you're the first person I've read who, you know, just talk about entropy and, you know, I could barely even say them, you know. So, you know, it's thanks to you that I am actually learning at the age of 63 some science and political philosophy. But
sure. That's a difficult question to answer. Mm. When I first began to realize the gravity of our ecological civilization, and this is before I'd begun any kind of formal spiritual practice, I did experience some despair. And then something out of my past education led me toward what I would call the tragic view of life or the tragic sense of life. Oh, this is the way it is. This is the way it always has been. This is just a new episode in a continuing story, as you say, of whatever arises has the capacity to pass away. Buddhism 101, even though I didn't know it was Buddhism 101 at that point. And that got me through the writing of the first book. And by the time that was done, I had a year or two later, I began my Buddhist practice. And then that combined with my previous life experience, being a Foreign Service officer, I saw some quite amazing things. I had a very strange education. I'm an ex-Harrovian, believe it or not.
USA, say again?
I went to Harrow for 2 years.
Oh, did you? Oh, I didn't know that.
I was a wicket keeper on my house's team.
You had quite a life.
Yeah, so I packed an awful lot of experience into my life, one way or another, and that, as I say, pushed me toward a tragic view of life even before I encountered Buddhism. And the encounter with Buddhism has only increased the depth of that. And if I may say so, I think through practice, I have quite strongly developed equanimity. And you know, things arise, things fall, and you're just sitting there in the middle. You know that this lifetime is only one bead on a long string, and you don't take this so seriously.
Well, that view of lifetimes, I think, is crucial to part of that, isn't it? That because we have this idea that consciousness is an epiphenomena of the brain, which will be snuffed out at death, you know, which we all believe in, like as a religious, as a religious belief, really, completely unsecured.
So in that way, my Buddhist career has reinforced my intellectual and career and my personal life to lead me toward that. Very thankfully.
And it's interesting, you know, that Buddhist practice helps you see that all things arise and pass away. But what strikes me as well is that you've got the altruistic vision of Buddhism as well, which is we don't just sit and watch that, we do what we can to help.
Do what we can to help and make things better.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I did another podcast, the fellow asked the final, well, if you could wave a magic wand, what would you do to change the world for the better? And I didn't really want to say this, but he kind of pushed me into it because he knew I was a Buddhist practitioner. And I said, everybody should sit on a meditation cushion for a year. The world would be transformed.
Yeah, that's right. That would be a good place to start, wouldn't it?
But obviously that is not going to happen.
No.
Even if I magic wand.
No, indeed. No. And it's amazing. We get so many people here at the London Buddhist Center, but a tiny minority continue.
Yes.
You know, that's just how it is, you know.
It's I think it's too hard for people.
Right.
And it's too painful.
Well, it asks a lot of people to grow and to confront themselves and to confront the truth of life rather than live in fantasies, which we're very susceptible to, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
But there you are.
Yeah. Well, that's a really good place to finish, Patrick. It's so good to talk to you. I've so enjoyed reading you, and you have broadened my mind very considerably. I can't believe the things I've been reading because of your writing, you know. And I think you are really trying to help us see who we are, first of all, without sort of self-recrimination, and then help us think we need frugality, we need simplicity, we need fraternity. Particularly fraternity keeps coming back to me, that we're more and more, we haven't got time to talk about it now, but I was very struck by your discussion of hyper-individualism, for instance, which I'm seeing more and more, where, you know, you think that society has to fit around me. But I just really want to thank you for your work. Even if I didn't, we weren't in conversation in this way, you know, I really wanted to, in a heartfelt way, thank you for all that you've given me personally, but for your work and how important that is, yeah.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed the experience, and I wish you and all your companions there well. Thank you very much, Bhante.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Very good to see you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.